The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this 7-day sesshin here at Turtleback Zendo in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, in March 2017. And again today I'd like to share with you some non-Buddhist writings that actually express, to a certain degree at least, the teachings of Buddhism, what we can realize. And again, Buddhism has a path, a very specific path, with practices that help us to realize these deeper truths that are quite liberating. But other religious practices, and even some non-religious practices, as I expressed the other day in talking about Flora Courtois' experience, or Jacques Lucerans' experience, they can reach that same depth of truth, because that depth of truth is inherent in each one of us. Every single one of us, along with the floor covering and the walls and the cars and the traffic and the trees and the squirrels and the airplanes overhead and everything else, is imbued with what in Buddhism is called our true nature or our Buddha nature. And we can realize it through these, making use of these tools, if we do it long enough, steady enough, and persistently enough. But other paths have also been able to reach the same truths. Meister Eckhart, for example, in Christianity, has experienced the same truth. There's different vocabulary, but the truth is the same. The experience is the same, even though it may be couched in different terms. And so I'd like to share with you something of the of a speech that Socrates made a long, long time ago at this point, seemingly lifetimes ago. I was in a profound dark night of the soul. Somebody handed me a little book called The Wheel of Death, which I learned later, Kapla Roshi, who had put it together, abhorred the title. He wanted it to be The Wheel of Life, because that's really what it was pointing to, not death. But the publisher wanted it The Wheel of Death. So The Wheel of Death it was, until eventually it went out of print. And one day, decades later, a new version of the book came out, and that was called The Wheel of Life and Death. In the book, it was a very small little book. There were only 4 chapters. Death, dying, karma, and rebirth. And in this dark place that I was in at that time in my life, I was deeply inspired and curious about these tales in the dying section of how Zen masters and other people, and Socrates included, could die so peacefully, without fear, so easily, so lightly in a certain way. What did they know that I didn't? And that's what set me on the path of Zen practice. And so Socrates' story was, of course, he was poisoned to death, forced to drink a cup of hemlock tea, I guess. At any rate, it was known poison, still is. And in fact, there's a group called the Hemlock Society that offers people specific instructions on how to end their lives. But this cup of hemlock took a little while to take effect, although apparently not terribly long, and his students, Socrates' students, were gathered around him at the time, wailing and carrying on, just as the Buddha's students were doing the same thing at the same point in his life, although he was in, 80 years old. It's not like he was forced to drink a cup of hemlock. He was dying naturally, although some say that it was because of food poisoning. And Socrates said, why are you crying? How do you know that dying is not entry into an amazing experience? I'm paraphrasing this here because I don't have the exact words nor that book in front of me. But he was not at all afraid. He was not at all concerned, even despite the fact that he was being poisoned. He was condemned to death. And that was the first possibility that maybe there's something else that we don't know. And there certainly is. What I'll read to you now may be a little bit controversial because apparently Socrates was known for his favoring young boys. And that's brought up here in this writing. But independent of that, hear the rest of his words, because he's saying something important here. And also there's the words of his teacher, who apparently was a woman, also speaking. And we'll share these. This is a speech that he gave This was actually recorded in some form by Plato. And in the introduction of it says, "This the first of the following selections is from Socrates' famous culminating speech in the Symposium." This is in the 4th century of our era. And it says, "Most of the speech is a long quotation from his teacher, Diotima. He prefaces it by saying, I want to talk about some lessons I was given by a Mantinean woman named Diotima, a woman deeply versed in this and in many other fields of knowledge. She is the one who brought about a 10 years postponement of the great plague of Athens on the occasion of a certain sacrifice, and she is the one who taught me the philosophy of love." So here is Socrates. "Whoever has been initiated so far in the mysteries of love," and that has a capital L there, "and has viewed all these aspects of the beautiful in due succession, is at last drawing near the final revelation. And now, Socrates, there bursts upon him that wondrous vision which is the very soul of the beauty he has toiled so long for. It is an everlasting loveliness which neither comes nor goes, which neither flowers nor fades. For such beauty is the same on every hand, the same then as now, here as there, this way as that, the same to every worshiper as it is to every other. Nor will his vision of the beautiful take the form of a face, or of hands, or of anything that is of the flesh. It will be neither words nor knowledge, nor a something that exists in something else, such as a living creature, or the earth, or the heavens, or anything that is, but subsisting of itself and by itself in an eternal oneness, while every lovely thing partakes of it in such sort that however much the parts may wax and wane, it will be neither more nor less, but still the same inviolable whole." And this is a description in different words, an attempt at a description, I should say, of our true nature. nor will his vision of the beautiful take the form of a face or of hands or of anything that is of the flesh. It will be neither words nor knowledge nor a something that exists in something else, such as a living creature or the earth or the heavens or anything that is, but subsisting of itself and by itself in eternal oneness, while every lovely thing partakes of it in such sort that, however much the parts may wax and wane, it will be neither more nor less, but still the same inviolable whole. It cannot be described. It is everywhere and nowhere. It is in us and we are within it. We can't touch it or picture it or speak of it in any way other than an attempt to describe it. And yet it is the most real of real. When we open to even a small aspect of our true nature, it is liberating in ways we cannot even conceive of as liberation. Freedom beyond freedom. And this is what is our birthright. We are born with this. We cannot be without it. And if we work hard, we will be able to open to it and experience that liberation. Of course, then we need to continue on to open more and more completely to this experience and to awareness of it. It is transformative. It is freeing. It is why we come to practice, whether we realize it or not. Some sense, some hint, something beyond the veil, as someone once described, that we know is vital to return to. And so we sit for long hours, our knees hurt, our back hurts. We get bored, we get frustrated. We find ourselves not wanting to do the practice or longing to do it. And all along the way, we open to whatever it is that keeps us from seeing that truth with a capital T. And that's, as you've heard in the days preceding this, is not a fun place to inhabit. And yet it's essential in terms of being able to let it go. In order to become free, we need to see most of where we are caught. As we are born, we are gradually conditioned. The experience of birth alone can be traumatic or not. Usually it's traumatic to some level. Painful for child and for mother both. And then as we grow, there's the first smile. Someone smiles at us. And somehow our face lights up in response. Hopefully somebody smiles at us. It doesn't happen to every child. And those for whom it does not happen grow up in painful ways and often end up being diagnosed as sociopathic or psychopathic. Because they've not had that interaction with a loving caretaker, that embrace that nurtures a child and also teaches a child how to live in society. And this is essential. Conditioning has a place in our lives. And it's important to recognize that. We don't want to try to get rid of all of our conditioning. As a friend of mine once, in giving a Dharma talk, said, I gather it's been a long time since I've read Alice in Wonderland, but in Alice in Wonderland, apparently, there are wild animals who are completely tame and will come up to human beings and interact with them without fear. It's a dangerous situation. There was a Zen master who when he found his monks in the monastery feeding the local deer, chased them away and chastised his monks, saying, if you feed these deer, they lose their fear of human beings and they will be vulnerable to being killed. There is a place for conditioning. It keeps us, hopefully, from being killed. It helps keep us understanding how to interact with the communities that we live in so that things function smoothly. Recently, I read that there's a strong increase in biracial children. And some people have this idea that that's going to make racial prejudice disappear. But the reality of it is these kids often find they don't belong in either segment of society. It's important to know the rules of society and to fit in, and conditioning makes that happen, usually, enables that. And there are cultural anthropologists who think that actually conditioning in terms of being accepted by the group is genetic, because it was so vital in ancient times, and we're talking prehistoric times really, to be part of a group, because it was only within a group that there was enough person power to be able to pull down a woolly mammoth, for example, or survive a saber-toothed tiger, or otherwise manage in a fearsome world. And so to not fit in with a group is still felt by some people as a sentence of death. And this is why shunning is so impactive a punishment for people. If we're cast outside the group, it's frightening. It's lonely. It can be extremely painful. So we get conditioned. We learn that one kind of behavior is acceptable and another kind of behavior is not. And as part of that conditioning, we develop an image of ourselves. We're good or we're bad. We're elegant or not. We're good looking or not. We're wise or not. We're smart or not. We're popular or not. And we see how important this is, especially as kids become more aware of peer pressure, for example, to conform in certain ways. And that self-image that gets developed as a result of this can be so painful, so detrimental, that people actually commit suicide because of it. The Great Depression, when the market crashed overnight, there were stockbrokers who literally threw themselves out of windows of buildings to die because it was too embarrassing, too painful, too negative for them to feel like they had somehow caused suffering or made a mistake or weren't the successful stockbroker, the wealthy person, the wise person that they had so long felt they were. This self-image keeps us imprisoned in many subtle ways. And the practice is about opening more and more completely to that self-image and so becoming free of it and able to experience the deeper truth of existence, the truth of oneness, the truth of joy, really. Let's see if we can find some more writings that might help us express that. This is another one that bears a certain amount of translation because it's written in terms of Christianity. This is by Maximus of Tyre, who lived in the 2nd century AD. And this is what he wrote. God himself, the father and fashioner of all that is, older than the sun or the sky, greater than time and eternity, and all the flow of being, is unnameable by any lawgiver, unutterable by any voice, not to be seen by any eye. But we, being unable to apprehend his essence, use the help of sounds and names and pictures of beaten gold and ivory and silver, of plants and rivers, mountain peaks and torrents, yearning for the knowledge of him, and in our weakness naming all that is beautiful in this world after his nature, just as happens to earthly lovers. To them, the most beautiful sight will be the actual lineaments of the beloved. But for the remembrance sake, they will be happy in the sight of a lyre, a little spear, a chair perhaps, or a running ground, or anything in the world that awakens the memory of the beloved. Why should I further examine and pass judgment about images? Let people know what is divine. Let them know. That is all. If a Greek is stirred by the remembrance of God, by the art of Phidias, an Egyptian by paying worship to animals, another person by a river, another by fire, I have no anger for their divergences. Only let them know, let them love, let them remember. You could say, transform some of these words and say, true nature itself, the father and fashioner of all that is, older than the sun or the sky, greater than time and eternity, and all the flow of being is unnameable by any lawgiver, unutterable by any voice, not to be seen by any eye. But we, being unable to apprehend this essence, use the help of sounds and names and pictures of beaten gold and ivory and silver, of plants and rivers, mountain peaks and torrents, yearning for the knowledge of it. Yearning for the knowledge of it, and in our weakness, naming all that is beautiful in this world after this nature. Just as happens to earthly lovers. There's a scroll hanging above the altar at Mountain Gate, on which is written in Chinese characters, out of not one thing I rise the 10,000 things. Out of not one thing arise the 10,000 things. It is the same as saying, God himself, the father and fashioner of all that is. Out of not one thing arise the 10,000 things. And there is a koan that says, out of not one thing arise the 10,000 things. What do the 10,000 things go back to? We try to picture it. We try to name it. We have Buddha figures on the altar. We chant the teachings of the Buddha. But there are still fingers pointing to the moon. And it is the moon, the experience of the moon, of what the moon represents, that is liberating. It's not the fingers, and yet we would prefer often to stick with the fingers. or with moments of joy, and assume that they are the real thing. True awakening brings something far beyond joy. When my brother died at this point, almost 3 years ago, my brother, who had no interest whatsoever in religion, and in fact told his wife he did not want a funeral, which caused no end of pain to his mother-in-law, who was a fundamentalist Christian and was sure he was going to hell if he didn't have a proper funeral. Before he died, he told me, and this was 3 days before he died, he said, "You know, I've had a good life. I have no regrets." My brother was 2 years younger than I. He wasn't supposed to die before I did, but he did. He got an aggressive cancer and was gone very fast. To be able to say, "I've lived a good life, I have no regrets," was rather remarkable for anybody. Perhaps my brother had no religion because he needed none. And after he died, 3 days later, what initially I could feel was a kind of vague grief and sadness and puzzlement. We all have the capacity to feel each other's feelings. So this was no surprise to me. And then after 4 hours, it shifted and became indescribable. The only way I can attempt to describe it is to call it luminous transparency, far beyond grief, far beyond sadness, far beyond puzzleness, totally, totally awakened. This our natural way of being. And we too can reach that. It's built in. We just have to get out of our own way. When we have reached enough of a depth, we find paths opening. We find a natural sense. Some call it a still small voice, but it's a kind of knowing from our belly of the direction to move in when we are confronted with the need to move. And when we listen to that and move with it, it always works. It always works out right, even though it may not be what our intellect will assume that we should do. And if we have an idea of what we want to have happen and it doesn't come about, if we let go of that idea, then again, many other options, often options that are more appropriate and more rewarding and more efficient and all the rest of that, will open up. We'll be aware of them, where they were blocked, where we couldn't see them because we had this idea of what we had to have happen. There is tremendous potential in our practice, enormous potential for true freedom, the only freedom there really is. But as so many of the cultural tales express. In a certain way, we have to go through fire to be purified to the point of being able to reach it. There are so many stories in different cultures. St. George slaying the dragon, marching out to vanquish his fears, really, and his conditioning probably as well. Or Mozart's The Magic Flute, where he's Epigenio is given a flute that has magical powers to protect one no matter what circumstances one is going through, because he's going to have to go on a journey that will take him through several rings of fire. And this magic flute will protect him through these rings of fire. This is our practice, is the magic flute, really. Or the Ring Trilogy in Scandinavia, again, having to go through successive rings of fire. It is the same for each one of us, really. We have different ways of picturing it, different ways of of encountering it, but nonetheless, it's about turning and facing ourselves and seeing bravely where we're caught in our own ideas about ourselves, in our own conditioning, and in the seeing of that, to be able to become free of it. If we don't turn our backs on it. It's not, in the beginning, a comfortable place to begin walking into, but it's essential if we're to come to this innate freedom, because it's what's blocking the road. And once we get the hang of it, and realize that as soon as we turn and face it, and experience it, and allow ourselves to accept it radically, okay, I didn't think I was behaving like this, but I don't want to do it in the future, and I vow not to. And then somehow we're able not to have to do it. We're less caught by whatever that habit pattern of greed, anger, and delusion might be. And we continue to walk through that forest. In some ways, this is the dark night of the soul. The major spiritual leaders have all gone through something like that. Christ in his 40 days in the desert. Various other tales. It's a metaphor for what we also may have to go through. And it depends on how caught we are, what we'll have to face. But everyone has to face some degree of it. And at the very least, because human beings have an intense desire to live, we will be faced with the potential for dying. And if we recognize that eventually we'll have to die regardless, then when this fear of death, fear of disappearance, fear of annihilation does come up in practice, and it probably will, then again, to walk right into it, to embrace it, to experience it as fully energetically as possible, energetically meaning as the energy in our body, then it's amazing what can happen in such positive, incredible ways. I have a friend who actually happens to be a therapist. And during a session in Mexico, a long time ago, she was Mexican, had a Quechua experience. And afterwards she said, you know, I honestly thought I was dying. I really thought I was dying. It can feel like that. So be warned and be brave. Walk into it with your arms outstretched. It's like that expression so common in Zen, Let go your hold on the cliff and leap, hands held high, into the fiery abyss. It's the fiery abyss of our own conditioning, our own assumptions, our own ideas about ourselves. And it can lead to awakening if we dare go there. And I hope everyone does, because you will find it so worth it. So worth it. I think that's enough for today. And we'll stop now, recite the four vows. Thank you very much for listening.